Wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety, and today we are thrilled to welcome Suki Dillon to the podcast. Suki is a dental hygienist and an educator at Southern Ontario Dental College. Beyond her career in dental health, she's a passionate content creator and an advocate for health and wellness, and an avid bookworm like me. Suki is deeply engaged in conversations about menopause, perimenopause, and the role of alcohol in the South Asian community, and she sheds lights on topics that are often overlooked or considered taboo. So today we're going to dive into her journey, explore the impact of menopause and perimenopause, and discuss how alcohol use affects South Asian women's health. And this is a really necessary conversation that we want to challenge norms and encourage some open dialogue. So hi, Suki. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us a little bit about your personal background?
Sure. So I'm a mom of two. I have a teen, 17, who's hopefully going to university next year. And I have a tween, so somebody who's going to be turning 13. So two kids, girl and a boy. My husband is a nurse. He's a pediatric nurse, and he works here at McMaster Children's Hospital. So he's been doing that for, I think, like 24 years now. I've been a content creator for about 5 years, and a lot of my content is like what you just said. I like to talk about some books that I'm reading, and I've been showcasing a little bit more of the South Asian authors recently compared to before. I do a little bit of parenting discussions, a little bit of education, health, very little Sikh content as well. So just teaching people about the Sikh faith, and a little bit of entertaining videos too, which I kind of started during COVID, which I really do like to do. And then I did some series that have really taken off. So the menopause series, I did the alcohol series with my husband, cycle breaking, things like that. And yeah, I just love reading any type of book. I love researching too. I can dive deep into any sort of a topic. I like to do artistic things as well, baking, not cooking, and exercising as well.
So what led you to focus on health and wellness specifically within the South Asian community?
Because health and wellness is not really a priority for our community, right? A lot of us come from... This comes from our parents. Our parents were immigrants. Mm-hmm. They were on survival mode. And we really had no role models for health and wellness in the community. So the South Asian community also has different risk factors for various diseases. And some of these are modifiable. Like, we can work on them, like eating healthier, exercising. Not everything is genetic, right? So it depends on our habits. But also our community's health literacy is really low too. So no, like, a lot of people don't understand that the information that the doctors give them, how it can help them, but they also just don't understand it because of the language, right? So I wanted to kind of start to share a little bit about what I was learning, but in a format that was a little bit easier for the community to understand too. And I've just been going through my own health journey, and sometimes that could just be the spark that you need to start sharing that with other people.
What were some of those personal experiences that shaped that for you?
Pretty much it's going through perimenopause. I think I was in denial of it for about 5 years. So when I started to share that I was going through these symptoms, women started to relate to that. And there was a lot of women that came out saying that they didn't know that they were also going through perimenopause. And they didn't even know there's treatment options available, right? Like, we didn't know anything about this. Nobody's talking about it. And the fact that perimenopause or menopause could also impact your future health, like with osteoporosis or cardiovascular disease, none of us knew that. Oh, that makes sense. That's why my mom has osteoporosis or my mom has heart disease, right? And a lot of these women, they just thought these symptoms were in their head, right? So I decided to take that risk and to keep sharing. Once I shared the first video, I just kept sharing any information that I was learning. And that's always what I try to share is this is just what I learned. I didn't know this. Mm-hmm. And I think people really take to that. It's not me telling you what to do. It's just, you know, sharing, right? And so I tried to inspire women, hopefully to they can advocate for their own health the way that I was doing. And it's working because I get maybe one message every day that someone took the step to see their doctor or to ask for treatment options that they didn't even know existed before. So they feel validated just knowing that somebody else is going through what they're going through. And I've also shared a little bit about how that healthcare system is lacking at this stage of our lives. So hopefully that doctors are getting that message as well.
Yeah, the perimenopause conversation is something that's come up with my friends and I maybe for the last year and a half, 2 years. So how do you engage, especially with the South Asian community, to raise awareness about issues like this?
So the best engagement is going to be through my comments or the DMs that I'm getting mm-hmm. on the videos. I usually take screenshots of really important conversations, and then those conversations usually become a future topic. So then I will research it. I'll find an answer if I can, because if one person's asking, there's a chance that a lot of people still don't know that, right? Mm-hmm. So I just did one that was on that health literacy and how important it is to be health literate, but it's really hard when you don't understand science and you don't understand medical terminology yeah. and the doctors don't communicate it properly with you. So it's not entirely your fault, right? So even in that video, I shared other accounts to follow that were evidence-based so that people would also have another place to go to if they're looking for that type of information. But I also engage with the community outside of social media. I helped mm-hmm. organize an initiative here where we actually took in a cancer screening bus, paramedics, people like that. They went into the Gurdwara, so the Sikh place of worship, and they were talking to the community about high blood pressure and how their food can have an impact on their cholesterol and all sorts of things. And the cancer screening bus was there so that they can go and get a mammogram or whatever they needed. It was great, but we now know it could be better. We needed more Punjabi speakers to translate. So that's mm-hmm. something that we have to add for next time. Because even I can't do that. Like the medical terminology, I use my Punjabi when I have to do something like that, right? So I'm very involved in the community. I kind of work in my city and I gauge with them just so that I can know what our needs are. And then if there's a way that I can help fulfill those needs.
Yeah. I don't even know if my parents would be good Punjabi translators for health terms either.
Yeah, you'd have to learn the terminology to be able to
Yeah. So what is the general level of awareness of menopause and perimenopause in the South Asian community?
The general awareness is very low because because women's reproductive health is a taboo subject, right? Like a lot of families we're not talking about puberty, we're not talking about pregnancy, menstruation, sexual health, or menopause. And so when a woman goes through perimenopause, it completely changes her life. And then the signs and symptoms are going to affect her emotionally, mentally, physically. And then when we don't talk about this stage, women don't know that they can go to their doctor for help. And then they're not prepared for it, right? Like if somebody else was talking about it, I would have known about it 5 years ago, but I didn't. Because none of my cousins talked about it, or my mom didn't, or any older siblings or sisters, right? And then you're not prepared. And then you can't ask for any treatment options. So then you end up suffering and going through it all on your own. So all of that kind of tells me that the general awareness is very low.
Yeah. And so in terms of like cultural stigma, I have suffered from the cultural stigma of being South Asian and not having kids. And so there is this idea that I was sort of less of a woman almost in a sense. So is there something about that cultural stigma of going through menopause and perimenopause in the South Asian community?
There is. There any conversation that's about women's health, it's suppressed, right? Because there's a cultural norm in our community that keeps pushing privacy and modesty, right? Like we're not supposed to talk about these topics because it's about a woman's health. Yet you can probably talk about a man's health. It doesn't matter, right? And our community, it really values being stoic and then pushing through the pain, right? Like our moms did it. So when women feel like their moms had to go through that alone, well, then I shouldn't complain and I should have to do that too. I have to be stoic, right? Mm-hmm. But I found that it's really interesting that the stigma with discussing perimenopause in the South Asian community is also in other communities too. It's actually not just in ours. So the Black community and the white community. Mm-hmm. I've had white women also come to me and saying, we never talked about it. My mom never told me about it. And I didn't know that I was going through it. So this is kind of a global stigma, actually.
Yeah, I've read some of your content and I didn't know this. And when I read it, it clicked that do South Asian women go through menopause earlier on average than other communities? So yeah, what is that statistic?
So most of our common symptoms actually will be different from Black and white women. So this is based on my research. We don't really get hot flashes as much as other women do. For us, it's exhaustion, joint pain, and low libido. Those are the main ones. And so when you get that, the doctors might dismiss your symptoms because it's not the typical symptoms that everyone else is coming in with, right? We also go through perimenopause in our 30s. So the average age for a South Asian woman is around 45 to hit menopause, which is about 5 years sooner than Black or white women. The average white woman's about 51. So again, if you're 45 and perimenopause is usually 10 years before that, so you're close to 35 when you start to have signs and symptoms, doctors are dismissing it because they're saying, no, it's too early. There's no way. And then you're also in denial because you're like, no, I can't be. It's too early. But in fact, yeah. It is. Right. Like if I look back, I think one of my first symptoms was 9 years ago, one of my first ones. And now I'm just going, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then slowly other ones started to come in and started to build. Right. And so again, women are not seeing their doctors, right? They don't even know if their symptoms are all related to perimenopause because we're not talking about it. So they're confused.
Yeah.
Like, oh, maybe this is just a blood issue or maybe I'm going through something else. South Asian women also tend to manage all of their symptoms on their own, like by not going to a doctor. So they will exercise, they'll rest, they might change their diet, but they might also look for Ayurvedic therapies or homeopathy or anything like that. But we'd rather not go to a doctor. We'd rather try and take care of it ourselves.
What are those traditional remedies that the South Asian culture uses for managing menopause? And does that actually work?
There's no research on any of that.
That's okay.
So for me, it's just like, I know that it's out there. I know that they're not going to a traditional Western doctor. But that's also the reason is it's just our culture, right? We do like to do traditional therapies that came from India. And we trust those therapies. But there just may not be any research on it. So I can't even say if there's something that works out there. I really don't know.
Yeah. My boyfriend was born in India. Hey, babe. And he says the weirdest stuff to me when I am sick. He'll say things like, this will cool your belly. And I'll be like, what does that even mean?
Yeah,
the old wives' tales and those traditional remedies are fascinating. But on top of that, how does South Asian diet impact menopause symptoms?
I actually asked a doctor a similar question to that, a South Asian doctor, and even she had said there's not a lot of research that shows whether or not we're more beneficial with our diet or not beneficial. The only research I did find was with the Japanese community where they consume more soy, but they've been consuming more soy for generations. It's always been in their diet. They tend to have less symptoms. And there is some research with what soy does to the body, and I'm still researching that on my own to see how I need to incorporate it. But for them, it's always been there in their diet. We don't know if just all of a sudden incorporating soy would work, you know? Mm-hmm. But nothing specific for South Asians, though.
That's interesting. I had a nutritionist on a few weeks ago, and it seemed like soy we just associate with estrogen from what she was saying. If we're consuming a lot of soy products, we're increasing our estrogen. And I was like, oh, I didn't.
I think it's a type of estrogen so it can kind of mimic what estrogen does, and it's still supposed to help you with your symptoms. But again, I need to take some time and look up the soy part because I'm still lacking in that area, but it's definitely on my radar that I feel like I need more soy.
I'm vegetarian, so I get some soy, but I had no idea they were related until a few weeks ago. And we talked before we started a little bit about the Sikh religion. What role does religion play in shaping attitudes about menopause and South Asian community?
Oftentimes culture plays more influence over what we do more than religion, right? Like we tend to do whatever the whole community is doing. Like even when you think about what will people say, like that's cultural, right? That has nothing to do with religion. And that has a huge influence on whether or not we're talking about menopause or if we're talking about anything, even like alcohol, right? Mm. But there's, you know, some research that if you do follow some sort of a spirituality that could provide a little bit more mental support, right? So it could have a positive effect on your coping skills.
What are the prevailing attitudes towards alcohol consumption in the South Asian community?
Alcohol is celebrated in the South Asian community, right? It's seen as like that magic elixir, and it helps get you through tough times. So we'll see that people are using it kind of like a medication. It uplifts their mood. Mm-hmm. And people using it for happy times, so like birth, weddings, family gatherings, but I've also seen it being used for grief. So it's like a medication for sadness. But it's basically seen as something that helps you have fun, right? Like it's associated mm-hmm. with fun. If you want to have fun, you drink. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's expected now in the community. Like you expect it when you go to someone's house. You expect it at a wedding. Like if there was no open bar at a Punjabi wedding, people would be fuming. It's expected, right? So consuming alcohol is now normalized, I think.
Fuming, and they would be talking shit behind your back saying, they must not have the money.
Yeah, because it actually gives you a bit of status. So I find like people flaunt how much alcohol they have, or they take out all the good bottles, and it's showing your status with all of your guests, right?
Yeah, my parents, whenever we would move to a new house, my dad would set up, even if it was just a makeshift bar, he would set up a bar and display all his Johnny Walker and Crown Royal. And so now that you say that, I understand.
And as an immigrant, right? You're in a new country. You can afford the alcohol from here because supposedly it's a bit more expensive. So yeah, you're raising your status in the community, right?
So when I was growing up, my mom didn't really drink. When I got older, she drank wine. But what are the attitudes towards alcohol consumption for women versus men in the culture?
It's more normalized in circles for men, but it was shunned upon for women, right? Because there's still a stigma with women drinking alcohol. So culturally, I feel like women have always been told to be conscious of how their behavior reflects the family, right? So you're told to be modest, you have to bring honor. And alcohol use or abuse kind of goes against all of that, like the honor, the izzet. And so a lot of women who drank, they were also assumed to be immoral. They would assume that, oh, if she's drinking, then she's probably doing other things too. And so the women would end up hiding it. So I think that women have been drinking. It's always been hidden. It's just more open now. Like the times have changed where a woman now feels like, you know, there's this double standard with alcohol consumption. Like, why can men drink? Why is it okay for them but not okay for women? Right. So I can understand why women want this equality where they feel like we deserve this. We should be able to drink it too. I get that. But it wasn't in my circles either. The women just didn't. And I don't know if they did in like behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. They just didn't see it.
Remember when I told you about True Diagnostics' True Age Test? I am obsessed with the idea of biological age versus chronological age. Let's dig a little deeper into what you can actually learn with this test. So with this simple at-home kit, TrueAge analyzes hundreds of thousands of markers on your DNA to reveal your true biological age and how fast you're aging compared to normal. And since 90% of aging is lifestyle and environment, knowing this information gives you the power to make changes that can actually improve your longevity. Should I be sleeping more? Am I doing enough weights? And TrueAge tells you how fast 11 key organ systems are aging, including your heart, brain, lungs, liver, and more. And as a former smoker and heavy drinker, I am curious to see how old my liver and lungs are. Also get a breakdown of more than 75 key longevity biomarkers. So things like metabolic health, immune response, distilled into actionable scores. True Age was developed by doctors and scientists at Harvard, Yale, and Duke, drawing on one of the world's largest DNA methylation databases. So these insights are backed by science. What I love is that True Diagnostic doesn't just give you data, they give you guidance. Along with your results, you'll receive personalized recommendations, basically anti-aging biohacks tailored to you to help you improve those numbers and potentially reverse your biological age over time. It's like getting a roadmap to age better. I'm excited to see if my vegetarian diet is the healthiest option for me, or do I need to add a certain supplement to my diet? And the best part, it is super easy and convenient. The True Age test is done at home. No doctor's visits or big needles. It's just a quick, painless finger prick. No vials of blood or awkward urine or stool samples. It was so easy. You just put that tiny little sample in a prepaid envelope, and in 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. Fast and hassle-free. If you're serious about longevity or just curious about what your body's real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code CIS2025 to get 20% off your entire order. This is your chance to take control of your aging and make every year count more for your health. Visit truediagnostic.com and use CIS2025 at checkout to get 20% off.
Right.
And do you see it more now?
Yeah. I've seen it more like with the older women in our community. Like when there's a wedding, I'll look at these, I'm going to say they're aunties because they are much older than me. They were not drinking like 10 years ago, and now they're drinking. And they're drinking publicly. And I don't know if they really like the taste, because I've never liked the taste of it, which is one of the reasons that I stopped. I was like, it did nothing for me, which is why I stopped. I think it's part of the status. It shows their status. It shows also that they're closer to the in crowd. So that whole peer pressure thing, it still affects adults. Like when you're a sober person now and you go to either a wedding or someone's house, people question why you're sober. They question, why are you not drinking? Yeah. And the pressure put on you is like, you'll get 100 questions on why you're not drinking. And people assume then that you think you're better than them. And that's what they don't like.
Yes.
Right? They don't like that. They feel like, you're better than me? Like, so you're telling, they take offense to that. It's very offensive to either decline alcohol or to just say that you're not drinking. Right? Like there's no partners. It's really hard to be sober in the South Asian community.
Yes, there is for sure a cultural stigma.
And there's no support. So if someone is an alcoholic and they're trying to get to get through their treatment, to get to a point where you're now okay being surrounded by alcohol, because I'm sure that takes a long time, it's so hard to find that partner to be like, hey, will you also be sober with me? Right? Like it's really hard, unless that other person really knows what you're going through because they've experienced it. Yeah, you'll find that person, but it's hard. So a lot of times it's just been me and my husband, and we're on the dance floor and we're having fun. And some people still assume that we've had a drink because we're dancing and having fun, because there's no way you can have fun without alcohol, right? Like you keep assuming that the fun is coming from that. And I think that's really sad because we don't see it any other way.
Yeah, that's so true, right? We think of that in all social situations, but I think it is intensified in our culture because there's a lot of dancing.
Yeah.
And people assume the only way you can dance is if you're drinking.
Even at my wedding, I had a initiated Sikh. So, he has all the 5Ks, Articles of Faith, Sardar. He's dancing at my wedding. And so many people from the opposite side of the family said, how drunk was your uncle that day at your wedding? And I said, he doesn't drink. They refused to believe me because he just didn't get off the dance floor and he was completely sober. He's never had a drink in like 30 years, right? I think that's really sad that we only associate fun with alcohol.
Yeah. Do you think because for women, alcohol use is a little more stigmatized, do you think they struggle more when they end up realizing maybe they do have a problem?
If a woman is drinking, so she tends to have to hide it because of the stigma. Mm-hmm. Plus it's kind of disapproved of, right? Like they don't want anyone to know that they're drinking. And then because of that, they may not get the help that they need. So now that's going to delay their recovery because nobody knows they're drinking if you're hiding it. So you can't get that help. Right. So those women may end up drinking alone or at odd times of the day so that no one sees that. So the stigma in general could lead to either social isolation for that woman, There could be rejection by the family. And then there's feelings of shame, like you're bringing shame to your family, or even a self-doubt that like there's no way you're going to get better because there's no support, right? So the treatment and everything else that goes with it, it shouldn't be different for women, but it definitely is. The stigma definitely does affect women when they've got alcohol abuse.
Yeah. So I don't know if you have this in your family, but, you know, I got a ton of alcoholics in mine. And so, you know, they would be getting into fights and getting DUIs. But the idea that there was a problem with alcohol was something that we never talked about. And so how do you see alcohol dependence perceived in the South Asian community?
So because of the negative stigma that's associated with being alcohol dependent, that's one of the reasons still we're not talking about it. And then that just really becomes a barrier to accessing treatment, right? So if they have an alcohol dependency, chances are a lot of times the family will not support that person because there's more, we care more about what will people think, right? We're trying to project that image to the community that everything is fine in my home. Nobody has a problem. We're all good. Right. And so that negative stigma is still more pervasive for women compared to men. But because of the stigma, we're not tackling the issues. And so people are going through either treatment alone when they really should have their family by their side. And I find that's probably one of the biggest problems with it in our community, right? Because we're not acknowledging that there is an issue.
Yeah. So if we're not going to AA, what other resources are there?
I think in North America, we have actually a lot of access to like inpatient treatments, things like that. There are detox centers, there's outpatient programs, there's peer support, there's like, you know, even online services, there's a lot of things like that. But even I believe that with like in Ontario, we have a couple of organizations as well that are for South Asians. CAMH is a really big one, and now they do have cognitive behavioral therapy for South Asian Canadians specifically, which we didn't have before, which is amazing. We have another organization called the Punjabi Community Health Services. They have an addictions program, which again is something new. So we didn't have that before. South Asian specific resources that people can go to now, because you really do need culturally appropriate care. If somebody doesn't understand the stigma that's in our community, your experiences, even how immigration plays a role or trauma, language is another one. So like if this is your uncle or somebody, the language also has to be very clear and in their language, then you're not going to get any treatment, or those are all barriers to their treatment then, right? So I think it's really important. And we're lucky that we have that now. We didn't have that 10, 20, 30 years ago, right?
No, we didn't. You talked a little bit about trauma. So what role do you think intergenerational trauma specifically plays for alcohol use in South Asian culture?
So I know women who experience trauma themselves, that could lead to alcohol consumption. But for some women, it's also just the way they've been raised, right? You're raised in a really controlling environment, a suppressive environment. You're not allowed to do anything. And the first time you're allowed to do something is probably when you go, like you leave home to go to university. Right? Mm-hmm. That's when you might use alcohol as an escape, or you're going to be trying it for the first time. So you drink excessively, right? To make up for lost time. But it's also like if somebody's parents were either forced into a marriage or they experienced domestic abuse, those mothers are probably parenting their children differently. And so now we have always said that parents will always do the best that they can with the knowledge that they have at that time. I never blame parents for anything, but now their parenting style will impact their children. And that might impact whether or not a child will be dependent on alcohol, right? So there is intergenerational trauma that can influence alcohol use. But yeah, it's also like, you know, high expectations put on women, especially first women, right? We were talking about our job, education, all that, feeling like a failure maybe that you didn't, you know, fulfill any of the dreams that your parents had. Any of that could also lead to it. So some of it could be intergenerational, but some of it could be specifically your own trauma, right, that you've gone through.
Yeah, thank God I have therapy in half an hour. My God, you just brought up some stuff for me. So in terms of parenting, I'm not a parent, but I have nieces who are obviously the kids and grandkids and great-grandkids of a line of really great alcoholics. And I am terrible at talking to them about alcohol and drugs. I am just like, don't do it. Don't do it. And I know for myself, like I was exactly that kid that you described, which is as soon as I got out of the house, it was like I went nuts, right? I drank, you know, for all the reasons. And so how do you talk to your kids, or how can we talk to our kids about alcohol without being me and just saying, don't do it?
Which is first of all, you have to talk about it, because you don't want to just ignore it, because mm-hmm. it's going to come up at some point, right? And I think you really do have to also talk about the effects that it'll have on the family, the community, your health. People forget health. They're so concerned about what other people will think. And I'm like, do you know all the 0% alcohol is now safe? Like, I have to stress that with my kids now. All alcohol can cause cancer, mm-hmm. right? It's a carcinogen now. So I feel like addressing that stigma head on is really important. But we also have to teach children about peer pressure, because my husband has been in situations mm-hmm. where he has been pressured to drink and he said no about 50 times and the other people do not back down. So if adults are going through peer pressure, kids need to know that they need to get through that peer pressure and be able to stand confidently and say no, that I don't want to, right? And I think that as parents, I have to be the role model. But also, if they are going to choose to do it as an adult, to do it responsibly, right? To know how, if they're going to drink mm-hmm. it, when to drink it, to not use it as a crutch, to not use it as a medication. You should go to therapy for things like that, but you shouldn't be using alcohol for that, right? Like, I think that we need to see, we have to role model that for our kids, because you can't tell your kids, don't drink, and yet you're drinking excessively. I don't like that there's two different rules, right? It should be the same thing. Your kids are eventually going to be adults, right? And they're going to call out mm-hmm. a hypocrite when they see one. But I also think that we can have role models in the community, because we didn't even really talk about, you know, the music industry's impact on this, you know, movies' impact on alcohol use. And so we need more people standing up that are sober or talking about the negative effects of it, right? So people have someone to look up to so that hopefully they don't go down that path, or at least they're responsible. That's all it is to make sure that they are responsible users of alcohol.
Yeah, we touched on therapy. When I was younger, the idea of saying to my parents, I have anxiety or I'm depressed, it was like, you're depressed. I walked 5 miles to school with no shoes when I was your age, kind of thing.
We're not validated. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there, I think that's like another thing, right? Is that we don't really take like mental health seriously. We don't really take the idea of finding coping mechanisms. I don't think my parents are journaling, you know, yeah. about their feelings. Yeah. And so do you find that too, that there is a lack of coping yeah. mechanisms?
But that, there's like even coping or even self-care when we were talking about health and wellness. How many of our parents put their health yeah. first? They often don't until they get yeah. that diagnosis of something, right? That's when they're going to put it first. And again, it's because they sacrifice everything. They've always been taught to sacrifice stuff. So they don't put themselves first. And then we start to see that. And a lot of times that's the cycle that we have to break, is to make sure that we do take care of ourselves. Because if I can take care of myself, that's the only way I can take care of my family and my kids. And our parents never really got it that way. You know, it's that oxygen mask analogy. You got to put it on yourself first before you put it on your children, right? It's also coming to a new country. It's, you know, just the trauma that they experienced. They were on fight or flight mode, survival mode when they came. So a lot of them, you know, there was like one or two they see people that they knew. And so when they got together, what else are they going to do? They're going to complain about their issues and they're going to drink alcohol and stuff. So yeah, there's no, that was their coping, right? That was their coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't a healthy way to do it. I think going forwards, we just have to really teach our kids the healthier ways and to cry and to have emotions, right? That whole stoicism is being told to kids, you know, you're not allowed to cry, or, you know, toughen up. You could get through this. That's really not an appropriate response for a child, because having emotions is appropriate. You're supposed to feel something, right? That's what our humanity yeah. makes us feel. So yeah, we really do have to work on getting more people to acknowledge mental health, normalizing therapy, right? Normalizing any conversation like that. And I think this is a platform that helps, whether it's social media, podcasts, anything like that. This is the way that we break these stigmas. we just keep talking about it, right? So that it's no longer a stigma. People can have these conversations at home, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think that in our culture, look at mental health almost the same way as regular health, which is like until there is a major problem, we're not fixing it, right? And so there is not the idea of preventative or maintenance for those things. But you brought up something that I don't know a lot about, which is Bollywood movies, because I actually do not watch Bollywood movies, partly because I don't speak Hindi, and so I don't understand them. And so what is the role of alcohol in Bollywood movies depicted?
So I think that I'm not sure if it's more Bollywood. I think it's more, because I also don't watch Bollywood movies. They're too long. I don't have the time for it. But I think it's more music. I think the music industry actually has a more of a role to play when it comes to alcohol, because it's more pervasive in the music industry. They really glorify drinking as being something that's very glamorous. It's joyful. It's a luxury, right? And they normalize it. So all of the adolescents who are following that music, like if you look at Sidhu Moosewala and all these other people, they're the ones that are going to say, this is what the adult world is like. They're learning what the adult world is like through pop culture, music, and movies. Mm-hmm. And so that's influencing what they feel everyone's doing, even if we're not doing it. They assume we are, right? And that also applies to South Asian women. Like women also assume that this is something that is needed of me and I should also be a part of that culture, right? But yeah, I think it's more of the music industry than Bollywood. I don't know if Bollywood's using alcohol, to be honest. I should ask my daughter. She watches more movies than I do.
Yeah, I'm curious. I feel like when my parents watched movies when I was younger, the like drunk character was always this rolling around, like falling down drunk character. So I don't know how many glamorous depictions there were. I'm sure they were there. Like either you're a falling down drunk or you're very glamorous,
rich, high like, class
sipping champagne.
And I think that's what the movie and that's what the music into like those music videos really glamorize it. But you're right, when a movie will have it, it's usually stereotype as well. It's usually like a certain community member that might be the drunk or the joker, you know what I mean? So we have to also look at that they're also portraying that, and that bias then goes into the people that are watching that too.
Yeah, for sure. So Suki, as we kind of like wrap up, what are some resources in general for whether it's like what health resources do you think you want South Asians to know about that we don't know about now that might help us get
in Canada? Fraser Health has been doing a lot of work with South Asians, and they sometimes put out these reports, which is really great because those are the reports that I look at to get a glimpse of what's happening in the community. So Fraser Health is amazing. There's a lot of small independent people that have their own podcasts that are sharing South Asian health information. Maybe it's like, you know, like your podcast for sobriety and other things like that with different communities. There's a lot. I think you just have to really look for it. But you just have to be very careful of the misinformation, especially when it comes to health these days. There's misinformation, but there's also disinformation. So just be alert to make sure that what you're consuming isn't intentionally wrong to sway you into. If you have to buy something, then you already know that that's an ad and you shouldn't even be on that site, right? So you have to really look at that and take a look at opinions. You don't always have to choose somebody's opinion, because in the hierarchy of, in terms of like medicine and evidence, opinions are at the very bottom, right? This is why I try to use a lot of studies when I'm sharing my videos, is because I'm trying to work my way up that pyramid to this is a systematic review, or it's a meta-analysis. It's coming from a lot of research papers, not just one person's opinion, right? And even when I share that, it's not my opinion. I share research. So you just have to make sure you look for somebody that you can trust like that, who's giving you proper information when it comes to healthcare.
Yeah. And so what's got you excited right now? Like, what have you been working on?
So I've been working on a new series with Dr. Sheila, and we've been talking about menopause specifically with South Asians. And so we recorded one video, and I put the full video on YouTube, but we've been teasing people with small little video clips of just like really important conversations, bite-sized information. So that's on Instagram. And in coming up, I have a couple of community events that I'm really excited about. I've been asked to be the keynote speaker at a gala for the Punjabi Community Health Services. There's another event happening in May where I might be moderating a panel on menopause with women, and it should be for the South Asian community as well. And I really like that because then I get to learn from the people that are on the panel. So I get to ask questions that, you know, everybody has on their mind, right? And other than that, you know, just teaching and getting busy with my students right now. So that takes up a lot of my time.
That's awesome. And we will link to your social media so people can follow. Thank you for being here. And thank you guys for listening to Sisters in Sobriety. And we will see you next week. This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.